The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Practically Healthy. I'm Dr. Melina Jampolis, and I each week talk to the latest experts on topics about things that will practically improve your life and get you to be practically not perfectly healthy. My guest this week is a very interesting topic that I know almost nothing about, so this should be quite interesting. Welcome to the show, Ronan Levy. He is the co-founder and executive chairman of Field Trip Health and also has his own podcast called Field Trip. And jump right in and let us know what this is all about, because this is a whole new world to me. So I'm either going to have really good questions or really silly questions that make no sense. But tell us a little bit about Field Trip Health and the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who aren't aware, we're in the midst of what many people are calling a psychedelic renaissance. As psychedelic drugs for medical and therapeutic purposes are making a roaring comeback based on some incredible research starting from the 50s and 60s, certainly. But over the last 10 or 15 years, the research and the evidence and the safety and efficacy around drugs like ketamine, psilocybin or magic mushrooms, MDMA, more commonly known as ecstasy, and others have really popped into the spotlight with tremendous results. You know, we're seeing treatments with psychedelic assisted therapies showing orders of magnitude greater efficacy than current approaches to depression and anxiety treatments and other mental health conditions. And the safety profile of psychedelics is remarkable. You know, this is something that people have a hard time digesting, because for the last 50 years, we've been taught just how dangerous psychedelics are. And certainly with any drug, there's a risk. But when you look at the safety profile of psychedelics, they're amongst some of the safest drugs out there, bar none, including many pharmaceuticals. And so what we're doing with Field Trip is we're actually building out clinical centers for the delivery of psychedelic-assisted therapies, starting primarily with ketamine-assisted therapy, because ketamine is an FDA-approved drug as an anesthetic, and a form of ketamine has actually been approved for treatment-resistant depression. And positioning ourselves such that in the next couple of years, we expect to see that MDMA-assisted therapy will be approved for the treatment of PTSD, psilocybin-assisted therapy for the treatment of major depression, treatment-resistant depression, and beyond. And we think this is going to fundamentally revolutionize mental health and psychiatry. And so that's what Field Trip is. And the podcast Field Tripping is actually the name. It's Field Tripping. We try to differentiate a little bit. It's all about normalizing the conversation, which is, for many people, the conversation around psychedelics is still shocking. But when you hear about the number of truly incredible, successful, thoughtful, competent, capable people who have used psychedelics both in a clinical setting as well as maybe a recreational setting, productively, I think it really changes the conversation quite quickly. And that's what we do on the podcast.
So let's just back up a little bit. I mean, because again, this is something that I know nothing about and have not personally experimented with at all, although I'm not close to it. But psychedelics, explain what that term means exactly in more scientific terms, instead of, you know, when I think of it, I think of, you know, the hippies, you know, just tripping out, you know, at parties and kind of. So explain to us a little bit about specifically what psychedelics are, what they mean, what they do, and also then, you know, how they address these really, you know, significant clinical conditions.
Sure. So psychedelic refers to a broad class of drugs, and then there is some debate as to technically what a psychedelic is. By and large, most people accept the definition of a psychedelic as something that creates usually a visual and auditory hallucination as part of the experience, but isn't exclusively so. The classic psychedelics that most people think about, like psilocybin or magic mushrooms and LSD, they're a class of molecule known as a tryptamine, which is a very simple molecule, all built around the kind of core. This is not very scientific language, so I apologize, but the core psychedelic molecule, which is a molecule called DMT or dimethyltryptamine, which is something our body naturally synthesizes. In fact, current belief amongst some is, if you've ever heard of people who have had near-death experiences and they have the white light and they see their family members, it is thought that that's actually the body dumping DMT into the body as part of the dying experience, and it creates actually a trip or a hallucination that people report. And so drugs like psilocybin and LSD, they're just kind of modified versions of DMT. These are very much the drugs that the hippies used in the 1960s. And depending on who you talk to, some people think that's fantastic. Some people are still a little bit skeptical of what the hippies stood for. But I personally liked a lot of the policy initiatives that were driven forward by that counterculture. But that's a totally different conversation. What's different from what happened in the 60s and 70s and what's happening now is that these are not drugs that are being used in at a concert or a party setting or anything along those lines. They're being used in a context of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. And what that means is people will be administered a psychedelic, ketamine, psilocybin, MDMA. It induces a psychedelic experience. During the entire experience, there's a therapist, sometimes two psychotherapists present for the duration of the experience that are supporting you throughout it. And afterwards, what people find is they have a lot of insights. It helps them have a lot of awareness, change their perspective on past experiences or past traumas or life in general, and gives them an openness, and we can get a little bit more into the science of this, to actually change their life, to change their perspective, to change their habits, their mindset, anything along those lines. And the results of psychedelic-assisted therapies are absolutely mind-blowing. And that's not meant to be a pun. It really is quite remarkable. So right now, there is a phase 3 FDA clinical trial happening with MDMA-assisted therapy for the treatment of PTSD. And in the phase 2 and in the first leg of the phase 3 trial, involving two MDMA-assisted therapy sessions for the treatment of chronic severe PTSD, they found that close to 70% of participants no longer qualified as having PTSD after just two sessions. So we're talking about a near effective cure for PTSD after two afternoons, basically tripping out on MDMA with a therapist present. Now, it's a little bit more complex than that because there's a lot of preparatory work and there's a lot of integration work after the psychedelic experience. But we're talking about a near cure for PTSD, whereas the current best treatment plans hope to achieve a 30% improvement in symptoms versus a 70% near effective cure rate with no severe adverse events. We're talking about a near miracle drug with MDMA-assisted therapy. And we're seeing similar results with psilocybin-assisted therapy for the treatment of major depression and treatment-resistant depression. One study out of New York University found that a single psilocybin-assisted therapy session could provide antidepressant effects and relief for 5 years or more. One session, 5 years or more. These are truly remarkable results. And that's what we're talking about here. This is really, I think, I can't conceive of a situation where this doesn't fundamentally displace most current approaches to mental health care and psychiatry.
That sounds very interesting and promising. So let's just talk a little bit about the science. I mean, for PTSD, is it unlocking areas of the brain that perhaps are repressing that toxic experience or memory? Or I think it seems like the mechanism of action would be different for example, severe depression versus PTSD. And I noticed a lot of your guests on your podcast are former military, so I can imagine that that's, you know, a really clinically relevant, you know, therapeutic regimen. So, but what's the difference and what's the theory?
The theory, I'll touch on that first, is there seems to be a number of things that occur during a psychedelic assisted therapy experience. And when it comes to most matters pertaining to the mind and the brain, the truth is convoluted and we're not entirely sure how it works, but there's a number of strong theories that have been validated, at least by fMRI studies, looking at people during the experience. And what seems to happen is the effects seem to be the result of a combination of three factors. One is, with most psychedelics, they tend to create a very rapid onset of a serotonin release, and serotonin naturally boosts mood. So within 45 minutes to an hour of an administration of a psychedelic, people feel better, just naturally. Secondly, during a psychedelic experience, and this seems to be consistent across most psychedelics, people are often able to revisit past events, past traumas, and look at life experiences or global events from a different, more objective lens. So whatever triggers, whatever traumas, whatever baggage they've been carrying with them up to that point, they're able to look at these circumstances just differently and see them from a new light. And this is largely what I think, by and large, people try to achieve in cognitive behavioral therapy or conventional approaches to therapy. It just happens, instead of over the course of months or years, in one or two sessions that people are able to have these breakthroughs and see things differently. Thirdly, what seems to happen is that most psychedelics actually induce a state of neuroplasticity in the brain. And we get to see this expressed in two ways. One is that there is actually synaptogenesis. We've seen this with ketamine and psilocybin, that your brain actually starts to regrow neural synapses. So basically the cells that connect brain cells to each other. So you're actually creating brain matter to some degree and creating new connections, which tend to get destroyed through depression and PTSD. I don't understand the molecular nature of that. I won't profess to, but I do know that seems to happen with people who experience depression, and we see that it starts to get undone following psychedelic experiences. And during the state of neuroplasticity, people, you know, just like children are much more able to adopt new languages or new skills than old folks like us, during the state of neuroplasticity, people are able to adopt new habits or new outlooks and new mindsets and really entrench them. The way author Michael Pollan talked about it is, imagine taking a snow globe and shaking it up. It's like when the snow is all at the bottom beforehand, that was your daily life. With psychedelics, it's all up in the air and you actually have the opportunity to reframe it. Or another example that was given was, I know you're in LA, but if you can imagine cross-country ski tracks, you know, after people use them, and this is what has been seen in the brain, is that the more consistent thoughts you have, the easier it is to have those thoughts. So if you have depressive thoughts over and over and over again, it becomes easier to have those depressive thoughts. And one of the theories is that the psychedelic experience kind of acts like a new mountain of snow over those cross-country tracks, that you actually can start creating new tracks in your brain that helps you get out of those consistent thought patterns. And I've heard some estimates suggest that 97 to 98% of our daily thoughts are identical to the thoughts we had before. So you can see how that can be a significant change if you can break out of those patterns. What's happening in the brain at this time, what we do see in the fMRI scans, is parts of your brain that are known as the default mode network, which is where, in psychological terms, the ego or the sense of self tends to reside, seems to quiet down. So that part of your brain actually becomes less active, while other parts of your brain that don't normally interact start speaking to each other. And that seems to explain the synesthesia that people have during a psychedelic experience, when, you know, music takes on new form or words take on new meaning or anything along those lines. It's because your brain is actually talking to itself more and making different connections. And with your default mode network or your sense of self or ego quieted, you're much more able to change, because the ego, at least in psychological terms, exists to maintain your sense of identity. And when it's, you know, taking a nap, then you have that opportunity to change your self-identity, your self-expression. And that seems to be what's happening on the brain level, is different parts of your brain are active, other parts are quiet, and that enables people to make stronger changes in who they are.
So does the microdosing, it's small doses of ketamine, correct? It's
no. What we're talking about is actually large doses, large transformational doses. The evidence around this is all in large doses. There's very little evidence around microdosing right now.
But it's not enough to put you out, because I've undergone anesthesia many times for knee surgery and back surgery. I am a skier, so that analogy does. And I don't remember it being transformative or changing my, inducing any neuroplasticity that I'm aware of in any way. What's difference? And also, what's the difference? You say it's being used recreationally, and then also, you know, how you're using it, I assume, at your field trip health centers. Explain to me how it's different from what the hippies were doing, or did they have it right?
Well, I mean, I suppose whether they had it right or not is a question of politics and perception. But so I'll just clarify the difference between microdosing and what we're doing. So microdosing typically refers to sub-perceptual doses. So if you hear of someone microdosing mushrooms, they're taking small amounts that they don't or only notice very small alterations in your perception. To draw an analogy, microdose would be like having half a drink. You kind of feel it, but you're not drunk, you're not intoxicated, you just know your awareness is slightly altered. That's microdosing. The doses of ketamine we use at field trip, it's not a microdose. It is a sub-anesthetic dose. So you're not unconscious. You're still very much able to maintain your faculties. But when you close your eyes, you're very much in a psychedelic experience. You are having a shifted sense of consciousness during that time. And that's important because we want you to be able to remember the experience as much as possible, because there's a lot of insight and awareness that comes from that. With large doses, when it's done as an anesthetic, actually a lot of this research, particularly around ketamine, came out of the fact that anecdotally, and not a lot, many physicians reported that after using ketamine as an anesthetic, so knocking their patients out, those patients also correspondingly reported a significant improvement in their mental health. And that's what actually triggered a lot of the mental health exploration with ketamine, so much so that Dr. Tom Insel, who was the director of the National Institute of Mental Health about 5 or 6 years ago, declared that ketamine is the most important breakthrough in depression treatments in the last 50 years. And that was one of those things that was just a coincidental stumble upon, that people noticed that there was mood improvements following ketamine administration, regardless of the size of dose.
So the obvious question is kind of about abuse, because, I think in the proper, and I mean, I guess the same could be said for anything, I saw with Michael Pollan that he talks about opium, caffeine, and mescaline in his book. But, one of the things and again, this is just educating me, because this is something that's very new to me. I mean, it seems like there's potential for abuse. It seems like that. And then I'm also curious about the side effects. I mean, the idea of just being so out of control to where you're having visual and auditory hallucinations seems dangerous to me. Am I being naive, or is it only to be done under, monitored conditions to really have the true benefits?
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, so Michael Pollan has written two books touching on psychedelics. One is called How to Change Your Mind, where he actually subjects himself to a lot of these experiences. And it's a great read because it goes through a lot of the history and science around this. Risk of abuse, actually, when it comes to most psychedelics, is quite low. So interestingly, LSD, this may surprise folks, but Alcoholics Anonymous was actually inspired by an LSD trip. And the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous actually intended to use LSD as a treatment for alcoholism, because what we've seen is that with at least psilocybin and LSD and the tryptamine molecules, they tend to be anti-addictive, which means not only are they not addictive, so the risk of abuse is low, they can actually help people break other addictions. One study looking at smoking cessation actually found psilocybin to be the most effective smoking cessation aid, with something like 75% of participants significantly decreasing their smoking following treatment. A study came out about a week ago looking at ketamine-assisted therapy for alcohol use disorder, and people reported substantial reductions in their alcohol consumption. So again, with psilocybin and LSD and the classic tryptamines, there's virtually no risk of abuse or overdose. The LD50 is incredibly high, so you can't overdose as you could on, say, heroin or any kind of opiate. With MDMA and ketamine, there is a potential risk of abuse. Overall, it is relatively small, and I'm just talking if people are just taking it on their own willy-nilly. They just get access to it. What we're talking about and where all the evidence is doing this in a controlled environment. So we're talking about coming into a clinical setting. There's usually a doctor overseeing it, one or two therapists present. And while certainly it sounds scary having a hallucination experience for many, it is actually part of the experience. And when controlled by therapists and doctors who know what they're doing, the risks are extremely low. In fact, various studies have found that psilocybin, LSD, and ketamine are both, in terms of harm to self as well as harm to others, lower risk than many drugs that people would consider safe. You know, many people consider cannabis safe, and in these studies, they actually find it less risky for psychedelics than cannabis, and certainly less risky than many prescription drugs as well. So the risk of abuse is low. You know, if people take it in the street, can they go out and do something stupid like jump off a building? Absolutely. People can do that without drugs. They can do that on alcohol. They can do that on all sorts of things. So it's not a risk that's unique to psychedelics. But in the context that we're talking about, that risk goes to effectively zero because they're in a controlled environment with people overseeing it in a proper way.
So let's talk that it's all, you know, certainly refractory depression is something that I deal with a lot in my practice. You know, I feel like a lot of the treatments are just dulling the senses, especially serotonin-based therapies, you know, and then and there are, you know, side effects. So, and I do see PTSD, particularly with eating disorders in my practice. I see that quite a bit. So it's an interesting, you know, concept, you know, that I would approach with caution, but it seems like there's fairly robust research. I'm curious with your podcast. You have some guests that I know. What are some of the more interesting stories? Share with us a little bit. You know, I saw you had my colleague that I've worked with quite a bit, Dr. Mike Dow, come on, and he was speaking about bipolar disorder, I guess. But and a lot of the veterans is. Tell us some of the more interesting kind of success stories and also, you know, how this is done. I was curious also about your center, the health centers, because you talk about an integrative approach. So sorry, that's two questions, but let's start with some of the more interesting stories and then let's switch gears to hear a little bit more about your center and the integrative approach.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've had a number of amazing guests. Dr. Andrew Weil is probably one of the more interesting ones who came on to talk about his experiences. And you know, his perspectives were probably more extreme. You know, he attributes using LSD constructively to helping him get over his allergy of cats, for example. Now, there is evidence to suggest that psilocybin and LSD are actually anti-inflammatory, so it's not actually as ridiculous as it sounds. And certainly Dr. Weil's credentials speak for themselves. The interesting story is, you know, I'm not going to reference the podcast as much as some of the what we've seen in our clinical settings, which is we've had patients, you know, we've had a survivor of sexual trauma, for example, who wasn't able to look at herself in a mirror without revulsion, being able to look in a mirror and see herself as beautiful. You know, that was a really powerful story. We've had military veterans who lost all connection to empathy, feeling empathy following our treatments. I certainly have spoken to people like Marcus and other military veterans on the podcast who attribute their work with either ayahuasca or psilocybin or other treatments as enabling them to have their lives back and repair their relationships with their spouses and partners and their children. So the spectrum of improvements is significant, from people who can't leave their houses to people who are just like honestly destroying their lives with alcohol and drugs, getting off those paths. And what we're seeing in our clinics supports that on an objective basis too, which is on average, a patient who comes in, and most patients suffering with major depression or refractory depression go through about 4 to 6 ketamine assisted therapy sessions over, call it, a 3 to 4 week period. We see that their PHQ-9 and GAD-7 scores go from severe to mild. And those benefits are sustained on average for about 120 days or more. So the average person will go many months with significant improvements. Many people continue with their SSRIs or conventional treatments if they're using them, but those benefits are sustained. And then people tend to come back, you know, on average, we see about 30 to 40% people come back for a single session after about 6 months or 9 months kind of thing. And that seems to become their cadence, which is they can maintain the benefits without a full course of treatment with just a single session, you know, interspersed over a few months.
So, and then with the PTSD, is it more of a one and done type of thing, or is that something that needs to be sustained as well as in terms of therapeutic regimens?
With PTSD, it's actually in our program. So we have our basic program for depression and anxiety, which is usually 4 to 6 sessions. And we do an integration session, which involves no drug, just pure talk therapy, taking the insights and awareness and trying to put them into action, interspersed after every 2 ketamine sessions. With PTSD, it's actually a more rigorous program. It's definitely 6 sessions. And usually there's an integration session after every ketamine experience. And then in terms of the sustenance and how long it lasts for, I don't know specifically for PTSD. The numbers I know off the top of my head specifically look at the PHQ-9 and GAD-7 scores, so I can't comment on that. But at least anecdotally, from what I've heard, many people report significant improvements and sustained improvements.
And in terms of, you know, acceptance by the medical community, is this something that, you know, I mean, MDMA is a street drug. I mean, ecstasy, right? Is this something that is legal in the United States? Is it? I mean, I know you're in Canada. Is this something that any doctor with the right schedule of prescribing from the DEA can do at this time? Or is this something that's more on the future horizon in terms of, you know, being an established medical modality?
So any physician with a DEA license can prescribe and administer ketamine. I certainly wouldn't recommend any physician who can do it to do so, because one of the things that's really important with psychedelic assisted therapies, at least in the studies, talk about how important the preparatory therapy is, how important the integration therapy is, and quite significantly, how important the actual location of the experience is. You know, if you're in a hospital setting with fluorescent lights and white walls and a whole bunch of frenetic energy around you, you're more likely to have a challenging or negative experience with a psychedelic than you are if you're in a comfortable setting. And so if you visit our website, which is fieldtriphealth.com, you can see what our clinics look like. And they've been described as spa-like or oasis-like, because we really want people to be at ease for their experience, to make sure they have a positive experience. And just as a quick note, because it often comes up in questions about the notion of a bad trip, current belief is that there's no such thing as a bad trip per se. There are challenging trips and there are easy trips. challenging trips can become bad trips if not properly supported, you know, and they can create their own traumatic experience on their own. Properly supported, though, what we found is that challenging experiences can be the most cathartic and lead to the biggest breakthrough. And that's why it's important that, you know, any doctor who has a DEA license shouldn't just go out and start doing this. You really want to make sure you have the right capabilities in terms of patient care and therapeutic knowledge to make sure that, you know, if people have a challenging experience, you're supporting them properly. MDMA and psilocybin are still Schedule I drugs in the US. MAPS, which is the nonprofit organization conducting the phase 3 clinical trials for MDMA-assisted therapy, expects the second arm of their phase 3 to be complete by October of this year, with readout expected by early 2023. So we could see FDA approval for MDMA-assisted therapy as soon as next year. On a regulatory basis, there are some states that just follow the federal government. And so if the federal government reschedules, then those states will reschedule. And then it'll just be about having the right DEA license again. For states that have their own scheduled list, then there's going to be some regulatory and political work that'll need to be done. Psilocybin is probably 2 years after that. So we anticipate the current clinical work is in phase 2B with psilocybin-assisted therapy. Late last year, a company called Compass Pathways reported their phase 2B results, and they found significant improvements through a single psilocybin-assisted therapy session as well. So we could see that rescheduled by about 2025, 2026. This is in the purely medical context. On a state-by-state basis, we see political action changing laws. So in the state of Oregon last year, I guess 2 years ago now, the voters in Oregon supported something called Measure 109. And so what Measure 109 does is it creates a legal regulated market for psilocybin services. And what makes this distinct from the FDA pathways is, unlike in the FDA, where you'd have to have a medical indication for a doctor to prescribe, in the state of Oregon, anyone over the age of 21 would be allowed to access psilocybin-assisted therapies, provided you don't have a specified contraindication. So by and large, these therapies are incredibly safe, but for certain individuals and groups, they're not recommended. Certainly people who have schizophrenia or severe bipolar, anyone with a kind of tenuous grip on reality, objective reality, as we call it, probably it's not a suitable treatment option. You know, people, at least with ketamine, with elevated and uncontrolled high blood pressure, it's not appropriate. But by and large, these modalities are quite safe, like I said, when properly supported.
So I have two more questions, and then I'm going to, sure, we'll refer our listeners to more resources to learn more about this, because I think it could be of great interest and benefit to the appropriate patients. Selfishly, is there any research showing that any of these psychedelics help with sleep? Because that's something that I personally struggle with considerably and have gone through every major medical modality in multiple combinations without any benefit. Are you aware of any research that shows any of these to be effective in sleep?
I'm not, but that's not necessarily not because the research isn't out there. There may be research. I'm just not familiar with it. It's certainly something I'll look into, but I don't know at this moment.
Okay. Well, maybe you can look in and let us know afterwards, and I can share that with our listeners. The other question I have is, you know, when I think of this, you know, I think of either people who look like Dr. Andrew Weil, you know, who is still more in the hippie, you know, schema. But also, I mean, how are people, you know, like I noticed you had Ben Greenfield on your podcast. Like, so how are these biohackers, I'll call them without disrespect, using this recreationally? How do they purport that it benefits them? Because clearly, I mean, I assume most of them don't have trauma or PTSD or refractory depression. So what are some of the things that an average consumer or somebody who wants to be super average gains from this sort of treatment?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree that not everyone has PTSD, but I would argue that everybody has some trauma in their lives, whether it's from a breakup or, a childhood experience or the death of a family member. We all have trauma. And the way I think about psychedelic-assisted therapies, particularly for those looking at it from an optimization perspective or a biohacking perspective, is I'm a big believer personally that everyone would benefit from just therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, going to a therapist once a week or once a month and talking through your stuff. I'm a big believer that will help. And the way I liken psychedelic-assisted therapies to that is kind of like going to the gym, which is you can go to the gym on a daily or weekly basis and work out, and you're going to make improvements most likely. But if you go to the gym with a trainer, you're going to make faster improvements, better improvements, and get more done in the same time. And that's the way I look at psychedelic-assisted therapy, is that we all got trauma, we all got things we got to work through, we all have struggles, we all have anxieties, maybe not at the clinical level, but they all exist. And these approaches are just very expeditious, generally safe ways to make significant improvements on those issues. And then going a step further, the research hasn't focused on this lately, but many of the studies in the 60s and 70s suggested that psychedelic-assisted therapies can enhance creativity, can enhance empathy, can enhance one's connection to the planet and nature. And really what I would consider to be very positive characteristics that are, never in too much supply. And so when we talk about the biohacker or the optimization community, it's people who are looking to make their lives better, not because necessarily they're struggling in a negative sense, but it doesn't mean we can't get more out of life. We can't be happier, can't be more fulfilled or connected. And I think psychedelic therapies, just like conventional therapies, are a great way to get there, just kind of faster.
Yeah, no, I think that's very good insight. And I definitely think probably everybody, if they had time, could benefit from cognitive behavioral therapy. Certainly, that is one thing that has been suggested for me for sleep, which I haven't. So I noticed you have a clinic in Los Angeles. I'm a part of me is terrified because I'm just somebody who doesn't like being out of control. So I've never, even just smoking weed is not something that I really enjoy because I feel like a loss of control. I'd rather be on more of a stimulant that helps me be hyper-focused. But now you've piqued my curiosity. I don't know whether I'll do it. I'm not promising listeners that I will, but I, again, because the sleep issue has been such the bane of my existence for over a decade, and I believe that there's more than likely some component of anxiety. And if I could address that and move on, it would be a game changer for me. So, I'm intrigued by this podcast. I appreciate you coming on and explaining things to us. And I think, the podcast is called Practically Healthy. None of us are perfectly healthy, and we're looking for practical solutions. Maybe this isn't ready for prime time yet, but I think there is a lot of promising research. And if there are people out there that are struggling with some of these conditions, I mean, I think it may be something worth looking into. So where can they go to learn more about this and about you? And you mentioned the organization and the field.
Sure. So people are more interested in learning more about Field Trip. Our website is fieldtriphealth.com. On socials, we're at Field Trip Health. Me personally, my socials are Ronan, Ronan, D as in David, Levy, so Ronan D. Levy, on Twitter and Instagram. Those are great places to look if you're interested in kind of robust coverage of the research. Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, is a great one to look at. MAPS.org is the website for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Definitely a great resource. Dr. Mike Dow and I are actually writing a book right now on ketamine-assisted therapies and best practices. So I'd certainly encourage you to speak with Mike about your anxieties. And then I'll leave you with one final thought, which is, I'm a big believer that the greatest mistake we make in life is thinking that we're in control, and the greatest fallacy is thinking that we'd want control even if we could have it. So, maybe it'd be a great experience for you. And I wouldn't be surprised, not being a therapist, but having done a lot of work myself, is maybe that adherence to control is one of those factors in affecting your sleep. Just speculating on that, but I wouldn't be surprised if we found that there was a connection there.
Yes, I wouldn't be surprised either. There's got to be something going on because besides just hormones, because I'm getting old. But anyways, well, Ronan, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and your wisdom and your thoughtful presentation of this new field to me. And for those of you listening, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. You've been listening to Practically Healthy. I'd love to hear your comments. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Have any of you ever tried it? Reach out to me on Instagram, on Facebook, any way you can get a hold of me. I'm very interested in this topic, and I want to know if you are too and what you would like to learn more about. So subscribe, like, and follow us, and we'll see you next week. Thanks again, Ronan.
Thank you.